always way too tall for me. Hi, my name's Eric Lyle. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to welcome our new member tonight. I don't know if this is your first meeting, first week of meetings. I mean, I don't know your story. I can tell you, when I showed up in Alcoholics Anonymous in September of 1985, I did not want to stop drinking. I just wanted all that bad stuff that was happening to stop. And the first meeting that I walked into, a gentleman was speaking. It was St. Vincent's on a Monday night. That meeting used to be like this whole room full. It was huge. And, you know, I was there. I was with a group of people from a treatment center. They had taken us there. And the guy that spoke that night, I think I mentioned this a couple weeks ago, but he had some serious, serious terminal health problems. And he got up there and talked about how thankful he was to be sober and alive in Alcoholics Anonymous. And how it, excuse me, and taught him to live and was teaching him how to die with dignity. And there was an energy there that night that I picked up on. And I don't know, at the time I didn't know what it was. I still did not want to stop drinking. But I knew there was something here. And eventually, for me, the consciousness of the group, that energy was there, was my first connectedness to a God of my understanding. And it started in that first meeting. I didn't see that for quite a few years. I mean, I knew that night, I knew there was something there. But I thought an awful lot about drinking after that, every day for at least 10 months, in the rooms, not taking a drink. But, you know, the answer for me was here. You know, it was in the book, and the sponsor that chose me showed me how to do this thing. And, you know, I'm just going to share my experience here tonight on 8 and 9. Made a list of all persons we had harmed to become willing to make amends to them all, and made direct amends except when to do so would injure them or others. You know, my sponsor and I talked about this, and Kevin mentioned something to me before the meeting, and early on, like those first formative couple, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, he said, there's going to be a point where there's going to be somebody that you would really put it to in front of you, and what you cannot do is try to make an amends before we go through this process. He says, because it's not gonna work out very well. And I listened to him about that, and one of those things was about the young lady that I was married to. You know, she had gotten sober. We both had sponsors. You know, we had been married for 4 years, drunk. And that didn't work out so well for us. And, you know, my sponsor said two things. I don't sponsor her, I sponsor you. So anytime you say Penny, I'm going to say I don't sponsor her, I sponsor you. And number two, you know, shouldn't make any like critical decisions this first year or two. I'm going to say one of those things you don't want to do is file for a divorce initially. First, you got to get sober and look at your role and why things are so weird and not so good. And then you two will have to figure that out. But I don't think you're capable of making a good decision right now. And he was right. I was not capable. I mean, getting up and putting my shoes on in the morning was a tough decision for me. I really was. To get up, not get loaded, and go to work on time every day was a big decision for me. Because I didn't know how to do that without getting loaded. Okay? So, there's a couple things I'm going to read out of here, and then I'm just going to share my experience with these things. And one of them, you know, right in the first paragraph about the eighth step on 76 is, we need more action without which we find that faith without works is dead. So it indicated to me, and he pointed this out, there's more action to do here. We have a list of all persons we had harmed and to whom we are willing to make amends. We made it when we took inventory. And one of the things I cringe at is when I hear somebody share at a meeting that they burnt their fourth step. Because unless they made a copy of it, they do not have this list they refer to here. I need that list of people, because I need the list of the people that I harm, and just as importantly, I need a list of the financial amends that I need to make. And it'd be real easy for me to forget about that if I didn't have that list in front of me. And he pointed that out to me. He says, you're just like I would. You will twist this thing around, and there'll be stuff in that inventory that doesn't get amended in step 9 unless you have that. He says, you're a quick forgetter, just like I was. So, I mean, he saw through my potential cons through this whole thing. I mean, he was a great sponsor for me. And later on in that paragraph, it says, if we haven't the will to do this, we ask until it comes. Remember that it was agreed that at the beginning we would go to any length for victory over alcohol. There were a couple names on this list that when I was doing my fourth step, I thought, there's no way that I'm going to amend my harm to that person. There's just no way it's going to happen. And what I found out through this process and in talking with my sponsor and some other people is that ultimately, I would never be free if I didn't, if it was possible, without harming them or somebody else. So I have this list, and it's not very long. You know, my parents, my in-laws, my wife, a couple childhood friends, one or two young ladies from high school, and a cop that had arrested me one night in Edinburgh. And briefly, you know, I was, and this was in the early 80s, so the attitude about DUI was a little different then. It was like a Saturday afternoon at 5 o'clock in the winter, probably around this time of the year. I'm in Edinburgh and I've been drinking for a couple days, and apparently I pulled into somebody's driveway to turn around because I met a couple people at this bar and we were going to go to another bar and keep on drinking, and Penny's not with me, and apparently I pulled into this driveway, put my car in park, running, and passed out. So the folks that own the place come out, hop in their car to go out to dinner, but here's this car running in their driveway with a dude that's passed out in it. So they called the cops. I mean, you know, that makes sense to me today. I woke up in the back of a police cruiser, and we're heading to the campus police station. And this guy locks me up, and for the next 4 or 5 hours, till we could wake Penny up, who was passed out from her own little run she was on, to come and pick me up, I just berated this guy. So, and this is the insanity of me. It's just typical of how I drank. I get released on my own recognizance. Didn't even see a district magistrate or anything. The guy who was the best man at our wedding was with her. He's driving my car. We stopped to get some gas in the bar that I had left prior to pulling into the people's driveway. It was across the street. I says, well, you know, and Penny was there kind of following us. I says, well, let's go drink. And that's what we did till 2 o'clock in the morning. I mean, I had no sense of, you know what, that's probably not a good idea, you know. And we drank till last call, and we went home and passed out like we always did. So anyways, there's this cop that really, and he had gray hair, and, you know, by the time I get sober a few years later and I'm doing this inventory stuff, I'm thinking, this dude's probably dead by now, you know. And I kind of tried to find out who it was, and I couldn't. I sincerely felt I owed this guy an amends, because he really didn't deserve the things I said about him and, you know, his mother and you know, other members of his family. And I talked to my sponsor about it, and he said, well, you know, you've done your due diligence. You know, you tried to find out who this guy was. So 3 or 4 years later, I'm speaking at the Sunday evening lead meeting over in Edinburgh. And after I'm done, this gentleman, about 60-ish, comes walking up to me. Got gray hair. He says, thanks for a really, really sincere lead, and you got to make that amends to the cop. And I says, what do you mean? He says, I'm the cop that arrested you. And the point is that I was willing, and wherever possible happens, you know, I was really willing, you know, and we had a few minutes outside, and, you know, I tried to correct that harm as best I could standing in the parking lot of a police station, because that's where the meeting's at, you know. But I come to find out that I wasn't the first 20-something kid in Edinburgh that he had seen at a meeting after he had arrested him. And he was a nice guy. His name was Matt. I think he may have retired and moved out of the area, but it certainly reinforced my faith in a higher power, because I was certainly willing to make that amends. So, you know, I've got this list, and you know, a couple of them were fairly easy. I mean, I was talking with my sponsor about it tonight on the way down. I had a part-time, full-time job. You know, it was supposed to be 45 hours a week, but I was doing good if I hit 40, and it was usually 24 to 32 on my paycheck, most generally. So, but there was days when I showed up and I was drunk, and my boss would say, you know, just go out into the yard, sleep it off for 4 hours, and come back and do some work. And I stole from my company. I stole time from them. And I felt strongly about this, and so did my sponsor. He says, you need to go and see how you could correct this. And we came up with a solution, and they put me on salary for a couple of years, and I made this amends to my employer. And it was important to me, because they tolerated my stuff for a long time, a few years. And I ended up working there 3 or 4 years sober, and then left for another opportunity. And I guess they saw a little bit of potential in me, and I was allowed to apprentice doing something, and ended up, you know, becoming my career for 20 years or better. So they really worked with me, and I'm forever grateful to them, because they easily could have just fired me and been done with my dumb shenanigans, so to speak. But they were good people. And when I left, you know, the president of the company, I went in and talked to him about it, and he wished me the best. And so it was good to see that, you know, you're sober and you're moving on. Because I was pretty young when I got sober, and I had a long work career ahead of me. I'm much closer to retirement now. You know, at 23, you don't think about Social Security and retirement and 401s. You know, you stay sober long enough, you start thinking about that stuff. So I made that amend to my employer. You know, I sat my in-laws down and made amends to them. And one of the people that I really, on a real deep level, disliked was my father-in-law for a couple things. And I had to put his harms to me aside and clear my side of the street and try to be a son-in-law and to participate with a sincere mindset, okay? And my mother-in-law is a sweet woman. My father-in-law's passed. My mother-in-law is still alive. And you know, those amends are, you know, being a good husband to her daughter and treating her lovingly. And, you know, she's a widower now, but she still gets around really good. But, you know, when she needs something done, she's hesitant to ask me because she knows I work a bit. And I said, you know, that's the least I can do for you. If you need something done around the house, I'm going to come out and do it. You know, I need to be the son-in-law that you deserve. So those kind of amends like that to her have been kind of ongoing, probably more so in the last couple of years. You know, like I said, I had a couple childhood friends, and, you know, my amends were well received. In one of those instances, that was a reciprocal kind of harm relationship. And you know, it talks about that earlier in the book, and even in the directions for this, that regardless of what they may have done to me, if I harm them, I need to go there in a prayerful, mindful manner and try to correct that harm. And this one guy in particular, it was pretty well received. he did not, and I had no expectation of him amending his ways to the harms he did to me. That's not what I was there about. In for me, you know, I had to be in the space spiritually that I could go in there and not expect that. You know, I can put expectations on a situation like that and just set myself up to be angry. This was not about me, you know. And even more so when I get to the amends to my wife. You know, I'd stolen a lot of money from my parents, and so I saved what I thought was about 10% of it before I went to make this amend. And, you know, I was sober 3 or 4 years. Probably 3 years. You know. And that part didn't concern me. The part that concerned me was I still was not comfortable being their son. And I don't know why. They were two very loving, spirit-filled people that, you know, they adopted me as a child. They showed me nothing but love. And I had no reason not to kind of have this disconnect. But I think a lot of that had to do with I realized how harmed and disappointed they were. And they were afraid. They were afraid they were going to watch me die. And that was the bottom line. So I went to my folks one Saturday. And I sat them down and, you know, the financial stuff was easy, really. And, you know, I laid the money out. I said, I think this is about 10% of it. And my mom knew exactly to the dollar what it was. And she says, yeah, that's about 10% of it. But we don't want your money and we won't take it. But I had to make that attempt. I know I had. And I didn't go in there thinking they're just going to forgive this, because my folks didn't have a lot of money. They really didn't. You know, and I looked at them both and I said, you know, how can I correct the things that I said and the actions that I took or didn't take, as the case may be? How can I fix that? Because I really didn't know. And my sponsor's like, you know what, I don't know what amending that's going to be for them. But my mom, you know, and I'm such a knucklehead sometimes, my mom looks me square in the eyes and says, call me once a week. I'm like, okay, that's a start. And she said, when you're driving through town on your fishing adventures, stop. So I started doing that. And then I started just showing up. And I started calling 2 times a week. You know, and my mom was nearing retirement. My dad was retired and he was really ill. And I knew he was going to die at some point. He died when I was, I don't know, 7 years sober. But I'd just go and hang out with my dad for the afternoon and watch a Pirates game. And that meant a lot to him. It seems insignificant. Those kind of things I didn't do from the time I was 11 to 23. I was not present in their lives. So they just wanted me to be present in their life. And that's what I started to do. And rebuilt these relationships I never really had with my folks. You know, and an ironic twist to all this stuff was my dad passed in 92. And actually, I have our daughter was born, and my dad died like 2 weeks later. And my mom, he'd been in a convalescent home for a year while my mom was getting retired. And she brought him home and went down. I got a picture of him holding my daughter, and he died 2 days later. You know, I think probably he willed himself a little bit to stay alive to see her. You know, Brianna's really bummed he never met her, because they would have got along really well. I know they would have. But so then was my mom, and I just started being present for her when she needed me to be present, and sometimes when she didn't. You know, I'd just show up and I was at the 10th and Powell meeting. This would have been late July, last day of July at 2006, and I got this new guy with me, and we're talking about this very thing we're talking about tonight. He had a similar background to mine, you know, 2 parents, worked for his father's construction company for a while, had done the same deal that I did, and it really estranged himself and alienated himself from his folks, and he had stole from them, all this stuff, and we're talking about this, and I says, I can assure you, I'm sitting here with you tonight, that if you do what's in this book, you're going to be able to correct that relationship. It's going to happen if you do what's in here. And we go into the meeting, and we come out, and I just get in the car, and Penny calls me and says, I just got a call from your sister. Your mom passed away. And I looked at this dude, and he's listening to this conversation, and he says, you gonna be okay? I says, I'm fine, but I think there's a message from the universe here for you, dude. You know? And, you know, he called me the next morning. I had to go into work for a couple hours and then go out and make arrangements. And I actually drove out to her house because the corner was just getting there and all that stuff. But he called me the next day. He says, you okay? I says, I'm fine, man. He says, you don't want to get drunk? You don't want to get high? I says, no, man. I never thought of that. I got some stuff to do here, man, you know? And that was that next step of making those amends, you know, taking care of their affairs over that next year. And some of that's not, if anybody's done that, it's not the most pleasant thing at times, you know? And I have a sister that suffers from mental illness, and that just throws a little curve to the whole story there, and you know, trying to mesh her well-being with trying to take care of this. It was just a really crazy week or year. And I remember I walked in a home group one Friday night, and I was just really at wit's end about a couple things, and Judy Miller looks at me and says, Eric, it's just stuff. And this was an Al-Anon telling me this, and I didn't say, well, you're an Al-Anon, what do you know? I'm like, yeah, it really is just stuff, man. She said, you'll be okay. You'll be okay. So, you know, that last night in her home, and before I closed and things were settled, I spent a couple hours there just kind of meditating. You know, it's a place I grew up and stuff, but I could feel the presence of my higher power and my folks, and it was a really nice moment, my sobriety, and I was like, okay, the book's kind of closed on that. You know, I've completed my amends. And it was a good feeling. I mean, it wasn't like overjoyful, but it was very fulfilling and a lot of peace. So that was a really cool part of that. You know, and then there's my wife. You know, we both, you know, it had real solid sponsorship, and you know, we still were really like on the edge, angry at each other for the first year or so. Friends of ours have repeatedly told us that you two are nuts, man, and you're really angry. And but some of that tempered probably in that second year. And you know, I distinctly remember doing these amends, and went to a meeting. It was a Friday night. Went to Skip Spader's Pizza for dinner after the meeting, and we sat in there for a couple hours. You know, we had a nice meal. And you know, before we concluded in making a decision that, okay, we're going to stay married, we're just going to see if we can do this thing, you know, there was a lot of stuff from our past that was ugly and dark. A lot of it we knew about each other. A lot of it we didn't know about the other. We just knew it was kind of there, hanging. But we also knew that no good service would be, it would not be useful to us in trying to do this path together, married, if we ever brought up any of that stuff from the past. And we never have. It just serves no purpose. And it's not like we forgot about it, because it's still there, you know. But if either one of us would brought that up, it would have been to attack the other person. And it just would not have worked. And we've been able to do that for 34 years. And believe me, you know, early on it was easy. Now, I mean, that's not even a part of our thought process today. But, you know, them first 5 years, man, that was, you know, it was getting to know how to be a husband. You know, and what love was about. And, you know, that continued on to this day, really. I mean, I remember in this, how crazy this thing is, you know, Penny got pretty ill a year or so after our daughter was born. And the doc's telling me about all this stuff that day at the hospital, and she's got this kind of cancer and blah, blah, blah. My first thought was so based in self. My first thought was, she's going to die, and I'm going to have to raise this little girl by myself. That was my first thought. Not, how can I be loving and useful to my wife at another level? So I called my sponsor, as it works, so I called a buddy of mine who was going again and in a program. He was home studying or whatever, and he says, you blankety blank, this is your opportunity to be loving at a different level to your wife. And I'm like, oh, okay. But I didn't get that. So it was kind of, okay, this is the next level of being loving and your husband, and the next level of amends. That's how I look at that. I couldn't see that in that moment. You know, those things they tell us to look for in step 10, I did not pause when doubtful. I wasn't agitated. I was really doubtful. There was doubt in my mind. It was fear. And man, I went there. And, you know, that's, for me, that's where my connectedness to other people and the fellowship doing this thing is so important. That, you know, within 5 minutes, I knew what the path was and knew what I needed to do. So, you know, that next couple of years was about another level of love and amends, you know. And it was rough, you know. I mean, she's got her own take on that. It was rough, but eventually we became comfortable with one another, you know, and that is complete. I mean, that's all I can say there. I got a wonderful lead of an ICKYPAW, International Young People's in Louisville in like 2003. It's the best three speakers I've ever heard at one time at a conference. But there was a young lady from Montana that got sober when she was 16. And she had two younger brothers. And one of the last times she was in lockup in treatment, she was like 15 or 16, it was Easter Sunday, she refused to let her mother near her, so she sent her two little brothers up to her with an Easter basket to the facility to give it to her, and she spat in her face and said, get the hell out of here. You know, fast forward, she's 30, she's been sober for 14 years, she's got her own house, her brothers have children and spouses, and they're walking up the hill, you know, she lives in this beautiful mountain outside of Butte, Montana, and her little brother comes up and hands her this yellow Easter basket with yellow grass and yellow eggs, just like the one he had in his hand when she spat in his face. And she just said, I knew then my amends were complete. I thought that was such a wonderful story, and that's not dissimilar to Penny and I. I mean, the path was different, but it took her 14 years to know her amends were complete. I mean, that's the power in this step. But right back at the beginning, it says, I got to be willing to do this thing. And I didn't necessarily want to do this stuff, but I wanted to be free from self and not always looking over my shoulder. Because believe me, I still sometimes don't like sitting with my back to the door. You know, it's old habits. But, you know, that looking over your shoulder constantly, that's how I lived for a long time. As a teenager, I had to start looking over my shoulder. And that went into my 20s, you know. What a freedom to be able to just walk down the street or drive down the road and not have to look over my shoulder anymore. So, interestingly enough, you know, and it talks about the domestic troubles, which I briefly touched on. It talks about, we don't do this if we're going to harm somebody else, you know, and a couple times I've had guys I worked with that were married or in relationships be pressed about, well, she wants to know, I said, under no circumstances, because not only are you going to harm her, even though she says she wants to be harmed, because that's what she's asking you to do, there's another person involved, and I have no right involving somebody else and harming them in this process, I just don't, and that's how I approach this. you know, the guy I'm working with now, you know, he's got his, we did his fifth a couple Sundays ago, and he's got his list, and we're just reviewing some of this stuff, and a lot of it's financial, but a lot of it's spiritual, emotional amends, you know, and he's got a couple people he resents that he also owes, that are past now, that he also owes amends to. You know, I talked to him about one in particular after my mom passed, about halfway through that process of settling my folks' affairs, I realized I had a resentment towards my mom. So I put it on paper, talked to my sponsor about it, went to the grave, took care of it. You know, he's got a couple situations like that. And I just totally lost my train of thought because there's something else we were discussing. It's neither here nor there. But I'm going through this process with him, and you know, the financial side of it is really daunting to him. You know, he wasn't employable for a couple years, although he's got a wonderful resume in multiple degrees. You know, and all he says, you know what? You know, day 47, you had a good day today, man. And tomorrow you're going to do what you did today. And, you know, you're starting to footwork towards re-entering the workforce. You know, you got to keep a focus on what you've got to do today, what you've got to do in 3 months. Let's set up some goals. But, you know, this stuff over here isn't going to happen unless you stay sober today and start moving forward. It's going to happen. You know, you've got a long work career ahead of you, and you've got a lot of, you've got a great resume, and you got a lot of education. You're going to be employable again. You know, you got to have the faith in your higher power. When I'm telling you, faith in this process, it will happen for you. I've seen it happen countless times. You know, and he also has some similar amends to, you know, a mother and a stepfather, and he was very indignant that his mother pulled out a list with every dollar he had borrowed from her. And I'm like, dude, my mom did too. The only difference between you and me is I was there to make my amends with some of that money, and she pulled out the list. You know, and they were comfortable with what they said that we were going to do about this, which was basically nothing financially. But, you know, I was there. You know, I says, dude, you really took it to them. I, you know, yeah, you harmed them financially. Now, I didn't pry into their finances. Maybe that's a drop in the bucket to them. I don't know. But you still harmed them, so you need to write this. You know, make a sincere effort. You know, we'll get into current amends, you know, next week. In the path I take in 11 to try to alleviate them. You know, I mean, we're going to talk about 10 and 11 next week, and, you know, that ongoing inventory that we do today, you know, seeing where I'm at right in this moment, and that pause when agitated and doubtful stuff, you know, I like to separate that from, this is the past stuff, and that's the future stuff. Both without completing my ninth step. And I didn't, you know, it wasn't like one day says, okay, the list is done. It just got finished. And the last time I spoke here, it was on 9, I think. And the one question that was posed, well, you didn't mention yourself. You know, your name wasn't on your 8-step list. And I said, well, it wasn't on my 4-step list. Because it doesn't talk in here about me. You know, yeah, I harmed myself. I was quite aware of that by the time I showed up here. But my experience has been this. By the time that this was completed, at some point I just realized I was okay with the human being I was today. You know, I'm not looking over my shoulder anymore. I try to be useful to my fellows. I try to be useful in Alcoholics Anonymous. I try to be useful in those other relationships that I have. You know, and sometimes that's with somebody I don't even know that you meet for that moment out on the street. I became okay with myself. If there's an amend to be made, that's it for me. You know, and I'm perfectly happy for that to be that. But, you know, nowhere did, and my sponsor didn't even have to tell me, don't put your name, should be on. I just knew. You know, I had free will, and it was running wild when I was getting loaded. You know, yeah, I hurt myself, but that was probably the easiest correction of all this. I mean, I just started using my little bit of intellect and abilities, showing up at work every day, and you know that harm of not having an education corrected itself. You know, being loving and centered and useful to my wife when she was ill corrected that part of me. I felt okay with that. You know, it just happened. It happens for me because I followed the path there. So I feel okay about the person I am today. And You know, that's you people, those 12 steps and a God of my understanding. I have no other way to explain that, but I'm okay with Eric Lyle today. You know, so that's all I have to share. And we don't have a mic, so we're not taking questions?
We're doing questions.
You're going to ad lib it? Okay.
So we don't have a microphone to carry around, but for anybody that has any questions for Eric, we've got time for one or two, and Eric will repeat the question to the
mic. Oh, now I got to remember. And listen, Dan.
Yeah, I appreciate you sharing, but just touch on living a myth. You hear that a lot in rooms where not knowing you're in harm with somebody who feels like, I know I'll never see them again. I'm not seeing them again. What
would you
rate for me to make sure
you're doing that? Okay. Well, similar to that, Dan wants to know about living amends, and I hear that a lot. I'm not quite sure what it means, but I can share with you something. And this wasn't my case. It was one of the guys I sponsored. You know, it was amends that he said he could never make because the person was dead. In this instance, it was his grandmother. He says, well, I can't make that. You know, I took like $2,500 from her. I says, well, that's something else I do with my guys. I have them get one of those 3x5 spiral bound notebooks. Every financial amend gets one page. So then we can go back and see where we're at with these amends. I said, well, what was your grandmother into? She says, oh, she donated to the Humane Society. She was up there volunteering. I said, this is going to be your amends, brother. Every month you're going to go and donate $20 in your grandmother's name. And you're going to get a receipt, and you're going to note it in that little 3x5, and when you get the $2,500, your amends to your mother, your grandmother's been made. So, I mean, what is a living amend? I guess I'm continuing a living amend to my wife. You know, I mean, we're still both alive. So I think those amends that maybe aren't wherever possible because the person's past, there's ways to make an amend. I mean, could you clarify what you were asking, Dan?
I did my history back in the day.
To people you don't remember. Well, I guess you could do that. I mean, in the age of the internet, unless they're really underground, I think you can find somebody if you... I mean, most people. There's some people that are off the grid. I get that. I mean, and then again, is it going to cause a harm if you make the amend? You know, I mean, you always got to factor that kind of stuff in. One of my guys, his sister, a strange sister, lived in Colorado. I said, well, we have Google. He didn't know where she lived. We found her in about 2 seconds. You know, okay, she won't talk to you on the phone, write her the letter. They talk about that in here, you know. So he was able to take care of that amends. Hey, Ryan, thank you.
No.
Would you just leave a message, or how's that work?
One of the young ladies from school, that was the case. I left her a voicemail and said, "Hey, it's Eric. How you doing?" Because I knew I didn't have to introduce myself by the last name. She knew who I was. It was a small high school. I said, "Hey, when you get a chance," and she lived in Pittsburgh. She had moved to Pittsburgh. I went to school there and had a family. And I said, "Here's my phone number. Could you please call me sometime when you have a chance?" Her folks still had a place down in Canada Lake. And a couple weeks later, she called me back, and I told her what I needed to do and why I needed to do it. And she's like, "Dude, it's not that big a deal." I says, "Well, it is to me. I need to do this, and I want to tell you that I was dishonest and selfish. And if you have ever felt harm from that up to this moment, I want you to know that I'm sincerely sorry. And how can I correct that?" And she says, "I've never felt that way about this relationship." But I left her a message, but I didn't say, "Hey, you know, I, her 12-year-old daughter hits the..." This is before cell phones, okay? You know, it may be, but yeah, I mean, you can do that. I mean, but I wouldn't make the amend on voicemail. I hope that answers your question, Ryan.
All right, thanks, Eric.
Thank you.